First of all, I wanted to welcome all of you, and we're so delighted that you're here. Without your presence, we couldn't run this program, and this is definitely my favorite week of the year, so I really want to thank everybody. And if you enjoy yourself today, please go out and tell your friends, your real friends and your Facebook friends, how much you enjoyed it, and encourage other people to come, because word of mouth is always the best publicity. Actually, before I introduce our speaker, I just wanted to mention that last year I tried to get a group together for a November trip to Israel. It's not a January trip, but it is run under eighth auspices. It's a trip for women, and other than being a woman, there are no criteria. So you can go if you're older, you can go if you're younger, you can go if you have children, you can go if you don't have children. So if anyone's interested in that, they should speak to me. It's not quite as heavily subsidized, so that's, oh, Rosella, we should talk and go again. Okay, so that's that announcement. Secondly, I also just want to announce that if you haven't yet signed up, we have a full week of really great programs. Tonight, Rabbi Skobach will be teaching Kabbalah and a Jewish look at Christianity, and I'm going to be talking about four Jewish habits for a good life, and that'll be across the parking lot at the GCC. We have a Shabbaton, wonderful Shabbaton at Beit Tikva, and if you'd like to join us, we'd love to have you. If you would like a place to stay in the neighborhood, please be in touch with me. And last thing, tomorrow's Lunch and Learn is Gun Rights or Gun Control with Rabbi Idan Sher. So I hope everybody will be back again tomorrow. I wanted to just welcome our esteemed speaker, Rabbi Michael Skobach, who's hiding behind the pillar in case he blushes. Of course, I would never embarrass him, because that would be a nice thing. So last year, Rabbi Skobach was here, and I think many of you were here, and I think because you enjoyed him so much, you're back again. And if you weren't here, you're here because you heard how wonderful he was. We feel very fortunate to have Rabbi Skobach, who works for Jews for Judaism in Toronto, where he does anti-Christian missionary work, and he works with young people, or maybe older people too, who have been involved in cults. And he's a tremendous Torah scholar in and of his own right. So he brings a fascinating blend of many different worlds and many different experiences. And he takes a full week off from his very busy schedule to come and join us here in Ottawa. And last year, the feedback was so incredibly positive that we reached out again and asked Rabbi Skobach if he would be able to join us, and we're delighted that he's here. So today is Rabbi Skobach on the occult and superstition.
Thank you, Lauren, for that warm introduction, and it's really special to be back here in Ottawa, where it's 2 degrees warmer than Toronto. Thank you very much. So I think last year at Lunch and Learn, I spoke about vegetarianism, and so I was asked to speak about something else that's very, very Jewish this year. Which is the occult and superstition, witchcraft, and stuff like that. Can everyone hear in the cheap seats? I can hardly see. Yeah. So I'll begin with a story. When I moved to Toronto in 1992, I was working at the University of Toronto as the chaplain, the Jewish chaplain, for what was then the Jewish Students Union, then it became the Hillel years later. And I was in my office one day, and I received a phone call from someone who was extremely agitated. It wasn't a student, it was a middle-aged woman. Turns out she was calling from more or less where I lived, a little bit north of the University of Toronto. And basically, her problem was that her apartment, or her house actually, I think she was living in a house, was haunted. She was being pursued by evil spirits, and her life was miserable, and she described really like a life of woe, and it was not pleasant. And she assumed that the problem was in the house. The problem was with the evil spirits that were haunting her house. And I, of course, you know, we didn't learn this in rabbinical school, and I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I could tell after just a few minutes of chatting with her that the problem was not the house. Now, one of the problems that I have, I must confess, I'm very bad at this. I'm not good at urging someone to get help. I just feel very uncomfortable. I'm not good at fundraising. I can't ask for money. So I just can't say to someone, you know, you need to see a counselor. You need to see a therapist. I can't get the words out of my mouth. So I'm thumping and I'm speaking very, you know, generally that, you know, I think maybe there are other things that are going on and maybe there are ways that you can get help. And I just didn't want to zero in on what she needed. But finally, after an hour or so, I said, you know what, I really don't think I can help you because this is not my area. And, you know, I think that it probably would be good to seek out some kind of counseling. I probably got it out finally. So she absolutely refused, and she insisted, no, my house is haunted, and that's where the problem is. And Rabbi, if you don't help me, I'm going to the priest across the street. So I said, you win. I know she's a Jewish woman. I'm not crazy about her going to the priest. So I said, I'll be up at your house in a while. So this is must have been around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And my house was on the way up to hers. So I stopped off and I told my wife, you know, I know I'm home early, but I need to get some stuff. Because I was thinking as I was driving home, so what am I going to do? You know, I'm not sure what I would do there. But my wife said, well, where are you going? And I said to her, I'm going to basically do some ghost busting. And she said, and to me, I really thought this was really a little bit off the wall. But my wife took it very seriously. My wife is much more spiritual than I am. And she said to me, I'm not letting you go unless you take 2 other rabbis with you. And I said to myself, oh yeah, I can just see, who am I going to get to come with me? How am I going to explain this to my 2 rabbis? So thank God I have a lot of rabbi friends in Toronto, and I knew just the right ones to ask, a little bit off the wall rabbis. So we got together. And we had a huddle. We huddled to discuss what are we going to do? Because none of us knew really what we should do. So the plan was the following. First of all, we're going to get her a mezuzah. We're going to stop off at the Jewish bookstore. We're going to buy a mezuzah. We'll put it up. Then the other thing we decided to get was a pushka, a charity box that will give her a pushka that she should put charity every day. And then we brought a book of Psalms, the Tehillim. We were going to say the Tehillim for the inauguration of someone's house, a Chanukat HaBayit. And basically we would talk about the house, and it's going to be special, it'll be blessed, and she'll have a mitzvah to do. And we thought that that would be adequate. And unbelievably, it worked. I would see this person periodically, and they would tell me, you know, Rabbi, thank God, my house is fine, no problem. And this went on for years and years and years. And then, maybe 10 years later, I run into this person in the parking lot and didn't have a good look on their face. And I'm given the following message. They're back. So, I go to my wife now, who is the spiritual one, and she said, look, we have to empower her. we have to give her something to do that will make her feel more in control of her spiritual surroundings. So my wife's plan was that, number one, we would take her to a mikveh. We would get permission, because she's not a married woman, and we were going to ask permission from a rabbi if we could take her to a mikveh, and we got the go-ahead. So my wife took her to a mikveh, and then my wife taught her about washing your hands in the morning. It's interesting that my wife basically was grew up in a Jewish home, but she was practicing for many years what I would call a North American form of Hinduism. She was basically into yoga and meditation and going to ashrams. And the first mitzvah my wife learned about, she heard a Breslov Rebbe, actually the Breslov Rebbe from Tzfat, of Gedalia Koenig, was speaking on a secular radio station in New York, and my wife heard him speak, and she never heard a rabbi before. She was blown away. And the next day she went to the East West bookstore in Manhattan, where all these Jewish freaks came, and the rabbi met with her for a few minutes and told her that she can continue meditating, but she shouldn't meditate about any foreign gods. And he told her about the mitzvah of washing hands. So my wife was always very attached to this mitzvah anyway, and she felt that if we taught this person about how to wash her hands in the morning, and that of all the things that it does, one of the many things that it does is it removes spiritual impurity from your hands. So that was the plan. My wife's going to take her to the mikveh, teach her about washing her hands, and hopefully that would work. So thank God that worked. It worked. And I actually saw her recently. Her mom was dying in the hospital. I went to visit the mother, and she told me, you know, Rabbi, the house is fine. Thank God. Now, after this happened, and this is my first experience with this kind of strange thing, unfortunately, once you open that door, so it comes to you. And so for the last 20-plus years, a lot of this strange stuff has been coming my way. A few years after this incident happened, I got a phone call from someone up in Richmond Hill, which is a little bit north of Toronto, just about a week before Rosh Hashanah, and they told me that their house was really badly haunted. And I was really not interested in even doing anything, but I'm a real sucker for people that are suffering. And so I said, look, I don't really know what I can do, but I'm going to try something. And I went up with my chauffeur. I wasn't trying to be funny, but I figured I'm just going to try this. And so I went up to my chauffeur, it was a week before Rosh Hashanah, and I just blew the chauffeur as loud as I could. And I said, maybe that will do something. I thought I was spiritually just stirring the pot. I hope in a good way. And I've never heard from them. Maybe they thought I was nuts, or maybe it really worked. But the problem that I had was that after I gave this kind of a talk once, and it went up on YouTube, I started getting calls from all over the place. Rabbi, can you come to my house? So please do not call me. Please do not call me. But I wanted to tell one more story before I got into what I wanted to share. What do they say, Yiddish expression? Before I speak, I want to say a few words. So this happened to me approximately 12 years ago. I went to Cincinnati, Ohio, and they have a really wonderful community kollel there. I've been there a few times, but about 12 years ago, I went to Cincinnati to speak in Cincinnati, and I think one of the surrounding cities maybe it was Columbus or Dayton. Anyway, I finished my speaking engagements, and it was time to come home, and they sent me to the airport, not in a cab, but there was someone who doesn't work, apparently, and will drive people. So this person is driving me to the airport, and 5 minutes into the ride, he blesses me with incredible blessings. I mean, he's holding forth must have been a minivan or what it was, a semi-truck, whatever it was, wasn't a car. And it was quite powerful. He's giving me all these blessings. And then in the middle of the blessings, he stops and he turns to me and he says, Rabbi, I think you need to get your mezuzahs checked. Now, what was strange was this. my wife and I had neglected to check our mezuzahs really for longer than they should have been. And so, really, literally before I went to Cincinnati, we called someone in Toronto. He's called a mezuzah doctor. And he comes to your house in the morning, he takes down all the mezuzahs, he checks them, and he puts them back up at night. And so we had arranged for this person to come the very next day. So here I'm driving to the airport to go back to Toronto, what is it, Wednesday night. Thursday morning, Dr. Mezuzah's coming, and this strange person says to me out of the blue, you know, Rabbi, I think you should get your mezuzahs checked. And it was a little bit creepy. And then he says to me, I think there's a problem with your front door mezuzah. Okay. Whatever. But then he says something that really spooked me. He says, Rabbi, on the second story of your house, now wait a second. How does this guy know that I have a house? How does he know it has two floors? He says to me, there's a bathroom. Okay, that's not implausible. He says, now across from the bathroom, there are two rooms. It's true. My study and my wife's art gallery. And he says, I think there's a problem with the mezuzahs on those doors as well. Now I'm just taking this in, and it's a little bit spooky. But the next day, Dr. Mezuzah comes, pulls down all the mezuzahs, comes back at night, the kach hava. And that's exactly what happened. The front door and the two rooms across from my upstairs bathroom, the mezuzahs needed to be fixed. Now, I immediately called up the Cincinnati Community Kollel, and I said, does this guy do this? And they said, yes. That somehow he has the ability to not just see your mezuzahs, but he can see a lot of other things. So, there are people who have the ability to know things. A good friend of mine, who I went to school with, he's now, I mean, I look up to him now as one of the leading rabbis of our generation, Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, told me once that he, years and years and years ago, went to see a great rabbi because he was having difficulty with something that he was studying. And the rabbi said to him, look, the answer to your first question is this. The answer to your second question is this. The answer to your third question is this. He had not asked any questions yet. Now I have to say that this avalanche of things that have come upon me over the past 20 so years, there may be a little bit of karma involved. Because as a child, I was a little bit mischievous. And one of the things that I remember doing was trying to puncture certain what I thought were superstitions. So one of the things that I remember hearing, and my family, we didn't go to synagogue that often, just basically on the holidays maybe, certainly in the high holidays and once in a while on Passover. But one of the things I remember hearing as a kid, I guess all kids, their ears would perk up if you heard this, is that if you look at the Kohanim while they're duchening, while they're giving the brachot, you'll go blind. Tell that to a kid, that's all they need to hear. So my friends and I thought this was just totally goofy. So what we would do every year on one of the holidays is we'd place ourselves behind some family, and then we would discuss among ourselves, you know, this doesn't make any sense. We would just out loud rehearse this, that, you know, you're not going to go blind, it's impossible. And the other kid would say, of course you will. That's the rabbi said, you're not supposed to look at the Kohanim. And then one of us, usually me, would just pretend to go blind and scream that they can't see. So I think that the master of the universe is helping me understand now that there are things that go on in the world that we just don't necessarily understand, and we just can't see everything. There's more to life than meets the eye. Now, one of the things that all of us know, regardless of where we live, or where we've lived, or where we come from, is that there has been an explosion of interest in the areas of the occult in our popular culture over the past, I don't even know how many years. I mean, it's definitely grown since I was growing up in Ozzie and Harriet times. Maybe it started in the 60s, maybe in the 70s, but there's been a tremendous explosion of interest in our popular culture about these kinds of things. First of all, it was reflected in the movies that started coming out, Rosemary's Baby and Damien and Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2 and Ghostbusters 3 ad infinitum, and the Blair Witch Project and The Exorcist, and there's just so many movies, I don't even know what they are anymore because I'm not in that world, but they haven't stopped. And this fascination with things that are odd and the occult permeates popular music, especially heavy metal rock music, with its focus on Satanism and black, the occult arts. It's in books, I mean, all of us know that probably the most popular series of books in our time were the Harry Potter books. There are 3,000 companies now that are publishing books on the occult. Sales are over $1 billion a year. When, I don't know if you know Toronto at all, but there was a big bookstore called the world's largest bookstore. I remember when I came to Toronto to visit the first time, a friend took me to see it, like it was a cultural attraction. And I said, this is not the world's largest bookstore. I'm from New York. We have quite a few that are 20 times bigger. But it was called the world's largest bookstore. And I used to do something regularly when I was working downtown at the University of Toronto. I would go there every month or so. I would check out the aisles of books that dealt with the major world religions, let's say Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And I would compare that section on the world's major religions to the books that were dealing with all of the occult topics, from crystals and shamanism and channeling and divination and tarot cards and I Ching and astrology and black magic and New Age and witchcraft and angels and Gnosticism and on and on and on and on. Those books way outnumbered all the books dealing with the normative world religions. Games, I mean, when I was growing already, you had Ouija boards and then later on Dungeons and Dragons and spell casting games and witchcraft games, fantasy role-playing games. This stuff is rampant. I don't know if they have this here, and I haven't seen it in Toronto for a while, but when I was living in New York, there was something called Learning Annex. And they would have adult education classes on any kind of topic that you could imagine. You know, how to knit, and how to find a lover in Toronto, and how to lose your Brooklyn accent. But a large number of these adult education classes at the learning annexes were dealing with out-of-body experiences, and how to see your aura, and things of that nature. Of course, we all know that every newspaper, do they even have newspapers anymore? At least when they had newspapers, everyone had a section dealing with your horoscopes. There are 1-900 numbers and other lines now on the internet for reading psychic readings. People like Sylvia Brown and other psychics make gazillions of dollars doing readings for people, contacting the departed loved ones. It is said that about 30% of police departments use psychic detectives. And of course, we even have today kosher fortune cookies. So, what is going on? So, I think that part of what can explain this is that there's been an increasing secularization of our society, and what it has done is it's left a spiritual vacuum. And we have a world where the pursuits are basically materialistic and running after more and more material success, financial success. What's happened, I believe, is that we, especially in the Western world where we have so much, we've discovered that the emperor has no clothes, and that this rush to a materialism and the realm of the physical, I would say, leaves us feeling empty. And what we do now is we seek ultimate answers to the big questions of life. Now, this was already prophesied in the Bible. The prophet Amos said that there's going to come a day when people are going to have, there's a famine that's going to come to the land. And the famine is not going to be for bread or for water, but it's going to be to hear the words of Hashem. Which basically means that we're going to live in a time when we'll have plenty, and we're not going to lack. The only thing we're going to lack is a soul. The only thing we're going to lack is a connection with the transcendent. And because I think we're living in a world where there's such an incredible vacuum for the spiritual, this is just one of the ways in which people are seeking to fill it. The truth is that the world is a very scary place. It's an extremely scary place that we're living in today. The times we're living in are very uncertain. And life is precarious. And people we know, all of us, that in the prime of their lives, they're gone. We know that people have scary economic downturns. Terrorism, global terrorism, is growing at a scary pace.
I don't think I pressed it. Is it going? Did I press it? I guess it's going. Okay.
It's possessed.
I'm sorry. I thought I didn't press it, but I think it's working. Okay.
It's 26 minutes in. It's still going. Okay. I feel like I'm one of these Jehovah's Witnesses coming to the house, because this is what they do, by the way. If you get one of their training manuals, they say, just talk about how scary the world is, and the environment's going to hell, and there's terrorism, and there's crime, and they paint this horrible picture about how terrible the world is. Well, you just need to read Watchtower Magazine, and that'll be fine. But for people who don't read Watchtower Magazine, the occult provides a way for people to at least feel they're gaining a degree of control over their lives. In a world in which we feel our lives are spinning out of control, one of the things that the occult provides is for people a sense that they're taking some degree of control over their lives. And we have that in the Jewish world as well. We have our own things that we like to do to feel that we are gaining power. You know, there's a thing I see at weddings sometimes, that people that want to get married, so they run after the chuppah to grab some of the broken glass from the cup that was broken. It's a good omen, it's good luck, whatever it's supposed to do, it's supposed to bring down some kind of energy that's going to help people get married. We know that people wear red ribbons to ward off the evil eye. As a matter of fact, the Kabbalah Center at one point was selling them for an exorbitant amount. I mean, it's just a red thread, but I think it was going for $25 or $36 for that red thread. There's a very interesting story I heard years ago about this very, very famous rabbi in New York, Rabbi Reisman, who teaches classes that get 1,000 people a week. So one of his congregants came to tell him that he has a huge court case coming up. Now, this congregant was a descendant of the Noam Elimelech. The Noam Elimelech is one of the great early Hasidic masters. He wrote the book he wrote, the famous book he's known for, is the Noam Elimelech. His name is Elimelech Lizhensk. And they had an original copy of the book in their family. And so whenever something big was coming up, they would take this book to the wedding that was happening, or to a bris, or to a pidyon haben. So he was going to this court case. He was working as a litigation lawyer for 3 years or so on this case. And the decision was coming, and he was going to take the Noam Elimelech with him in his attaché case to be there to get him through that day. Anyway, this congregant comes to shul that Friday night. Rabbi Reisman could see on his face, nishgit. He sees that he did not make his $5 or $6 or $7 or $8 million that he was expecting. So the congregant came over and said, you know, Rabbi, this really hurt. But what hurt even more was when I went to my father and I said to my father, Ta, it's not working. It's not working anymore. And my father said to me, did you ever read the Noam Elimelech? Did you ever read the book? Did you notice that in the back of the Noam HaMelech, in the very back, he blesses all his Einiklach. He blesses his entire family. And one of the blessings is that none of them should ever become wealthy. That was one of the great blessings. Of course, we also live in a world where the media promotes a fascination with the bizarre and with anything that tends to disparage normative religion. And it caricaturizes normative religion as trite, as out of touch, as intolerant. And so what happens is we live in a popular culture which rarely embraces traditional values, and they serve as a pulpit for the occult and for the new age and for a society that's seeking simple answers to complex problems. The truth is that virtually all new age and occult practices have already been anticipated in the Bible. They're not so new, the new age practices. And there's some truth to the old idea that the new age is nothing but recycled old paganism. Now, there's a famous dispute between Maimonides and Nachmanides when it comes to sorcery, astrology, and the occult powers. Maimonides basically says that you should just basically stay away from these things because it's nonsense. You're just totally wasting your time. Totally wasting your time. It's bubamises, it's nonsense, it's foolishness. There's nothing to it. Nachmanides, on the other hand, and basically all the other rabbis, say, no, that's not the case. As we just heard in our class, a wonderful class about astrology, the Torah would not refer to these powers as Elohim Acherim. The Torah, the Bible, refers to these powers as other powers, other gods. But the word here, Elohim, means powers. So if the Torah didn't think these things were powerful and were real, the Torah wouldn't take it so seriously. You see that in the Torah, there is an incredible focus on not serving these foreign gods. If it was just nonsense and stupidity, the Torah would just say it once and laugh at it. It's like a joke. But the Torah seems to take it very seriously. There's a famous story in the Talmud where one of the great sages was giving a class, and he was speaking about the kings of Israel and how wicked they were, and he stopped in the middle of his class. He couldn't finish, and he left off basically making a sarcastic remark about one of these kings. You know, he said something like, "Tomorrow we will resume our discussion about our learned colleagues." And he was sitting laughing, like sort of, you know, learned colleagues. So that night, this king came to him in a dream and asked him some very, very difficult questions in Jewish law. And the sage had no way of answering the questions. So the sage asked the king, "If you were so learned and you were so knowledgeable in Torah, how could you have worshipped those idols?" So the king says to him, "Look, if you were living back when I was living, you would have picked up your cloak and you would have chased the idols like me." Meaning that at some point in our history, there was a supernatural attraction that this stuff had for us. Now we can't relate to it so easily. And the Talmud tells us that what happened was that our sages prayed to God to take away that attraction. It was just so devastating, the attraction that idolatry and sorcery and witchcraft and paganism that this stuff had for us as Jews, that our sages had to say, "God, just take it away." And one of the things that happens in our world, it says in our Bible, in the book of Koheles, "Zeh le'umat zeh asa Elohim," that God created a world in spiritual balance. The world has to be in a spiritual balance, otherwise we would lose our free will. If there was too much positive, then it would be sort of a no-brainer to be living a spiritual life. And what happened was there was a time in our history where we had a temple and we had a sacrificial system and we had miracles and we had prophets and we had a tremendous world of positive spirituality. And that ended 2,400 years ago in terms of prophecy. It ended 2,000 years ago in terms of sacrifices, in terms of the temple. And so while there was a diminishing of positive spiritual forces, there was a diminishing in the power of these negative spiritual forces as well. They lost their incredible hold that they had on people. Now they're much more tame. But Nachmanides says, nonetheless, there is something to it. That there is a real astrology. That what astrologers are able to do is not read the future, they're reading the present. When you see, for example, the seed of an oak tree, you're not predicting the future that this is an oak tree. You're able to see right now that within this seed contains what's going to become a full-grown oak tree. So in our world, we don't see the way God operates. There are spiritual forces that are all around us. We don't see a lot of the waves and the electromagnetic things and a lot of the sound. We don't hear and see everything. So when God is interacting with our world, there are spiritual forces that come down. And if you're able to tap into one of these spiritual levels before it hits our reality, so you can tell what's going to be happening. And these are real, and these are powerful, and these are effective. However, the Torah says, don't go there. The Torah says that this stuff is real. Just don't go there. Now, it's got to be said that even though there is a real astrology, and even though there is a real power to the occult, there is a dark side to the spiritual forces of the world, what the Kabbalists call the Sitra Achara, the other side. It's important to emphasize that virtually all the practitioners of this stuff in the world today are fakers and don't really have any power. The person that makes a few bucks doing psychic readings, if they had any real power, they would go to Wall Street and make billions. If they had any real power, they would go to the racetrack and they would make millions. People that were healers, you know, I follow this in the Christian world. I get a lot of these Christian magazines where people say that they went to some place in the middle of nowhere and people were raised from the dead and people that were blind can see and people that had no arms, their arms grew back. I read stories like this. And these are Christian ministries based out of somewhere in Ontario. I said, well, if they could really do this, they would just walk into an emergency room and clear the emergency room. But, you know, the rabbis teach us, HaRotzei L'Shakir Yarchi Eduso. You want to lie, put your witnesses very far away. So, of course, you can do these miracles in the middle of Fiji somewhere, where who knows what's going on. Groucho Marx once went to a famous psychic who was telling people about their dead relatives. And everyone was gushing, you know, oh, my dead aunt and my dead booby or whatever, they're doing well, they're happy. So Groucho Marx asked the person, can I ask you a question? And the person said, sure. And Groucho Marx says, any question? Sure, go ahead. He said, what's the capital of North Dakota? Didn't know. Anyone know?
Bismarck.
Bismarck is the capital of North Dakota. Anyway, the vast majority of the practitioners today are charlatans. The Bible actually teaches us in the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy chapter 13, that false prophets actually might have the ability to do incredible supernatural miracles. And why does God allow them this power? Why would God allow people the ability to do things supernaturally if they're not good people? So the Torah says to test us. And so too, I believe that these occult powers, and even not the occult powers, even the fascination with the occult, because I believe most of what's in the world today is not real, but either the occult powers or the fascination with it, I believe, are here to test us. The Vilna Gaon, the great Torah sage, was once giving a lecture. And in the middle of his lecture, he had a small group of students, a huge thunderclap rang out. Huge blast of thunder rang out in the middle of his lecture. And the students stopped and they said the blessing for hearing thunder. And they saw that the rabbi's face looked very disconcerted. He looked very unhappy. And they said to the Gra, they said, did we say the wrong blessing? He said, no, you said the right blessing. But if you were really listening to the class, you wouldn't have noticed the thunder. And I think that what's happening to many people is they get so distracted from what they should be focused on, they pay attention to all the wrong things. So the Chedushe HaRim, this is a Hasidic master that I'm named after, Rav Yitzchak Meir of Gur, the first Gera Rebbe, told a story about someone that had an obsession for some reason that he wanted to own the best horse in the world. Don't ask me why, but this person wanted to have the best horse in the world. And he was very wealthy, he could afford anything. So he sent out his emissaries to go all over Europe to find the very best horse, the most expensive horse, and he finally found it. And he paid a fortune for some horse. So he decided, listen, if I have the best horse in the world, I've got to make sure that it's safe. So he built a very fancy schmancy stable for this horse, and he put on the door the most expensive lock you can find. So he felt it was very secure, but he says, you know what? There's always some guy that can pick a lock. I got to hire security. So he hires someone to watch the horse 24/7. So he goes to bed that night, but he says, tossing and turning, he says to himself, you know what? No one's able to stay up all night. What if this guy falls asleep? Then the place will be unwatched and someone can take the horse. So this big wealthy person, he gets dressed in the middle of the night and he goes down there and he sees that the person's wide awake. And he says, thank God you're awake. How do you stay up at night? So he says, you know what? What I do is I try to think about very difficult, complicated problems that I try to solve. And that helps me stay awake. So the rich fellow says, what are you thinking about now? He says, you know, I'm wondering, when they make a bagel, where does all that dough go? Where there's a hole there now. So what happened to all the dough? So the owner, you know, rolls his eyes and he says, oh my God. You know, but if it's keeping him awake, okay, thank God, I'm not going to say anything. So he goes back to his house, he tries to fall asleep, he's tossing and turning. It's 3 o'clock in the morning now. Oh, he's got to be, he must have fallen asleep now. So he gets dressed again, and he runs down again, and he sees the guy's awake still. He says, what are you thinking about now? He says, now? Oh boy. He says, now I'm wondering, when they put a nail into a wall, so what happens to all the wood that used to be there where the nail is? I can't figure it out. What happens to all the wood? So the owner is almost laughing now, but doesn't. The owner says, okay, just stay awake. You're doing a great job. So he goes back to try to fall asleep. He can't fall asleep. He's tossing and turning. It's now 5:30 in the morning. He says, no, the guy can't be awake 5:30 in the morning. So he runs down there. And he says, you're still awake. That's great. What are you thinking about now? He says, whoo, now? I got a real problem I'm thinking about now. He said, what are you thinking about? He said, well, you bought the most expensive horse on the planet. And you built this magnificent stable for the horse. And you put on this incredible lock that's the most brilliant lock on the planet. And you hired me to guard the horse. I'm wondering now, where's the horse? So what is the point of the story? Actually, there are many points of the story. I've heard it explained many ways. But one of the ways the story has been explained is that if you waste all of your energy focusing on useless things, so your Yetzer Hara can come in and just steal your right mind. People get very obsessed with the evil eye. I had a grandmother, and bless her, and bless you. So my grandmother was actually a very, very, very holy woman. Very incredibly, I grew up, I was very blessed to grow up where she lived with us for half the year. And I saw, I don't come from a religious family, but I saw a holy woman growing up who spent every minute either studying Torah or davening, or chasing after my father to write checks to give away her money for charity. It was quite amazing. But she was incredibly focused on the evil eye. So I grew up as a kid being spit at all the time. Poop, poop, poop. Poop, poop, poop. Poop, poop, poop. So the evil eye is not like termites. That's not how it works. Rabbi Dessler explained that the evil eye is not that difficult to understand. If we live our lives in a way where we call too much attention to ourselves, or we maybe don't live simply enough, and we cause other people to be jealous, they may either begin to pray for something to happen to us. You know, why should they have that kind of a house? Why should they have such a life? Or their jealousy might cause more scrutiny upstairs to really discern whether or not we deserve what we have. Maybe we got what we have out of grace, out of Hashem's chen. And maybe if a strict accounting was made, we wouldn't deserve everything we have. And so Rabbi Dessler says the way to combat the evil eye is not by wearing a wet string necessarily, or going poo poo poo, or saying bli ayin hara. I'm not poking fun at those things. But the real thing to do is to learn how to carry ourselves in a way where we're a little bit more inconspicuous with what we have, and we don't display what we have, we don't call attention to what we have. The best remedy is to learn how to live a more humble life, live more modestly. That should really be the focus. It's very easy to get too overly focused on tactics, on shtiklach. You know, the Torah tells us, tamim tihiya im Hashem alakecha. You should have a relationship with Hashem which is pretty much simple and pure. And don't look for shortcuts. Don't look to beat the system. Don't look to figure out what's going to happen. Go through life with a certain simple attitude, and not trying to game the system, not trying to figure things out, not trying to look for ways of beating the system. And so we're told in the Talmud that Chizkiyahu, the king Hezekiah, hid the book of remedies. At one point they had a book of remedies where they would be able to figure out exactly how to cure any problem. And this book was hidden by the king. And the sages praised him. Sages praised the king. And then he destroyed the copper snake that was made by Moses. And the sages praised him for this as well. So the Talmud basically analyzes, you know, this copper snake. And not just the copper snake, but when the Jews were fighting the Amalekites, and Moses raised his hands, and when he raised his hands, the Jews prevailed against the Amalekites, and when his hands couldn't be held up, the Jews started losing the battle. So the Talmud says, was it simply the raising of the hands? Is that was magical, a magical movement? That was the thing that won the battle? No. Talmud says that when his hands were raised, the Jewish people raised their eyes to heaven, and we prayed, and that's what won the day. It wasn't anything that was magical. And so the copper snake as well didn't cure anyone. But when people looked up to the copper snake, they looked up to heaven, and they were able to connect with God, and they were cured. So the reason that Chizkiyahu destroyed the snake and hid the book of remedies is because people began to look at these remedies as idols. They began to put their faith in the remedies. They began to think that these remedies, these drugs, these cures were what was healing them. And that's why the Talmud says, Tov shebarofim legehenim, the best doctors will go to hell. Why? Not necessarily, but the best, meaning it's the doctor that's the best in the sense that they have the biggest cure rate. And if they begin to think, look what I've done, the Talmud is saying, you've not done anything. You're just a tool in the hand of Hashem. But when we begin to think that the pills we're taking is what cures us, or the doctor we go to is what's healing us, that's the mistake. We're taking the eye off the ball. The Baal Shem Tov was once approached by a couple who were having difficulty having children. So the Baal Shem Tov said, look, I'm willing to give you a blessing and pray for you, but you have to give me 5,000 rubles. There's 5,000 rubles. Are you kidding? It's like a fortune. See, we don't have 5,000 rubles. And even if we go to all our friends, we can never get 5,000. The Baal Shem Tov said, look, I told you what I need in order to pray for you. So they went out. They tried to raise money. It was impossible. So they came back and said, look, Rebbe, we tried to raise the money. We can't raise. Please, can you just give us a blessing? We should have children. So the Baal Shem says, look, I told you, either you give me 5,000 rubles, or I'm not going to give you a blessing. And they said, to hell with your blessing. We'll pray for ourselves. Very good. Ultimately, God wants us to keep our eye on the ball. And God wants us to use what He gave us, the real tools, which is our minds and our ability to ultimately connect with Him. We're told in the Torah that we were not supposed to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What's wrong with eating from a tree of knowledge of good and evil? You would think that's a good thing, to have more knowledge, to be able to discern between good and evil. Whatever the tree of knowledge of good and evil was, why is that so terrible? And that you're going to die if you eat from it? It's a terrible punishment. So I think that one of the things the Torah is teaching us is, if you think you're going to get something as valuable and as important as knowledge by eating from a tree, then you're dead. That's already, the game's over. So the Torah tells us again, Tamim tiyem Hashem Elokecha, to live a simple, straightforward life with Hashem, and keep our eye on the ball, and not to get distracted by all of these either powers or attractions to these things that could be powerful. And I think that's what the Torah is teaching us. So if we have a few minutes for questions. What time do we have to break?
We have 10 minutes.
Okay, so other questions or...
8 minutes.
8 minutes. Okay, please.
My question is, all of us have some level of intuition. At what point is our intuition no longer a benefit to us? Does it fall into the category that we are speaking about?
I think that our intuition falls into the last thing that I said, which is that Hashem has given us a mind, and that we're supposed to use our minds. And one of the things I spoke about in my class this morning was the midah, the practice of silence. Is that if we are able to spend some time in our day in silence, we can get in touch with that inner voice, which is usually, I mean, you have to be able to discern, but usually these intuitive thoughts, for example, an intuition that a situation is dangerous, an intuitive thought that I shouldn't be doing X, those kinds of thoughts, I believe, I'm not sure I could say with 100% accuracy, I believe that those kind of intuitive thoughts should be trusted, should be listened to. I think most of us have had situations in life where we don't pay attention to those intuitions and we suffer the consequences. I think we need to teach children to be attentive to that intuition, to that inner voice, that if they have a feeling that they're just uncomfortable, not to ignore that, and to use that as a see it as a blessing. Then when we have these, because in some way these thoughts are coming to us, and I think they're generally coming to us from a positive place. Now there are times when our thoughts come to us and they're not positive. I think I told a story here last year that when I was working downtown at the University of Toronto, so I volunteered to lead a beginner's service for Rosh Hashanah. And so I was standing for about 4 or 5 hours teaching, and I blew the shofar for the crowd and taking questions. It was very exhausting because I had to put all of myself into it. And afterwards, during lunch, one of the rabbis who works in the hospital downtown said, would you mind going to Mount Sinai Hospital and blowing shofar for the patients? So my impulsively, I said, sure. But then about 10 minutes later, I said to myself, why did he have to ask me? There were a lot of other people who didn't kill themselves in the morning. And my lips are practically falling off from blowing the shofar anyway. And I had all these thoughts rushing to my head. You know, he could have chosen someone else. And why did he have to choose me? And I'm tired. And my lips hurt. And then I said, I really did this. I said, I know who you are. I know exactly who you are. You're my Yetzer Hara. You're my evil inclination. So there are times when we actually can spot him, like, you know, on a wanted poster. So there are times when we know when these thoughts that are coming to us, I don't think they're intuitive thoughts. I think these are the intrusions of our Yetzer Hara. I think when we have intuitive thoughts, a sense about something in life, I think we should learn to pay attention to it and trust it. I think they're blessings to us. It's just my belief. Yes?
What about the guy who was telling you your Mrs.'s faulty?
He was able to know certain things. Yeah, I mean, as I said, that I think a lot of these powers have been diminished, but they haven't been extinguished. And this was someone who had the ability. I personally have no idea how. And you know what? I would be scared if I had such a power. I really would. I wouldn't want to know, you know, for example, there are people who know things about you, right? I don't feel comfortable if someone in I meet knows things about me that I didn't tell them. But I would feel really uncomfortable if I would see someone and know a lot about them. That'd be like torture for me. You know, there's something nice about having mystery in life. And sometimes, you know, too much information. So, I wouldn't want to have that power. But he clearly did. And I checked it out. And since then, he told me, this guy does stuff like this. I can't explain. Yes?
Is energy healing within what you're talking about?
So, it falls generally within the rubric of what I'm discussing. And I should tell you that there's a big debate going now on in rabbinic circles about this kind of topic. About all these alternative healing modalities. There are dozens and dozens of them. So a book came out last year called Alternative Medicine, I think, in Halakha, in Jewish law. And it's a very thick book. And it basically takes the perspective that, by and large, these modalities for healing are okay. But posthumously, a book was published by Rabbi Yisrael Belsky, by his students, where he takes a very negative view of these practices. So what I would have to say is, at this point in our world, the rabbis have a split view about whether these kinds of energy healing practices are permissible. I know that it works, by the way, because when I terribly hurt my leg, a Russian woman came to my house and did energy healing on my leg, and I know that it worked. And I'll tell you a really spooky story. This one really spooks me. So I was at a friend's house for Shabbat a few years ago, and just as the meal was beginning, my eyes were tearing and itching, and I started to wheeze. I was going, I was not able to breathe. So now, I don't usually get that from cats or dogs. Usually it's just the itchy eyes and the congestion. But once in a while, I can't breathe. So I said to my host, "Do you have any pets?" And she said, "Yeah, we have cats." I said, "I gotta leave. I'm sorry, I gotta leave." So I got up to leave, and she said, "No, don't leave. Stay here for a minute." So she said, "Put your left hand behind your neck." I am not exaggerating here, by the way. "Left hand behind your neck, right hand on your forehead, and repeat after me." Now, as she's telling me to do this, I'm saying to myself, this is the stupidest thing in the world. This is the stupidest thing in the world. I really was. So she said, "Repeat after me. Even though this cat is making me extremely uncomfortable, I unconditionally love and accept myself." That's what I had to say. Without exaggerating, in a split second, didn't take more than a split second, there was 100% relief of all the symptoms. Now, how do you explain that? I can't explain that. But I know that these practices work. I also give you one other example. I carry this around. What is this? Oh, the name was worn off already, because you see how long I've had it in my pocket. I think it's called Cupricum Metallicum. Anyone here know about Cupricum Italicum. It's a homeopathic remedy for leg cramps. I used to get leg cramps. They were terrible. Now I don't get them as much. But what's in here? Absolutely nothing, basically. Nothing. They're little tiny, teeny tiny pills. You put them under your tongue, three or four of them. And whatever was in here has been titrated down 4 or 5 billion times. So the original substance, this almost, basically it's a hair, less than a hair above zero. So there's nothing in here. And yet, when I take this after I get a leg cramp, it goes away almost immediately. So I know this stuff works. I've had it done on me. However, the rabbis are not of one mind in terms of whether, I don't think they have a problem with this. They would probably just say you're wasting your money. But in terms of energy healing and some of the other practices that we have, they would probably either look at askance or they would say there's no problem. Okay, we had a question. Oh, yes.
Sort of related to a few other people. In terms of the spiritual forces you were mentioning, if someone doesn't do it on purpose, it just happens to them that they see something, and it's either to inform as a positive way or something that they know is going to happen in the next present time period. And is that still...
So the rabbis discuss that.
Okay.
The rabbis discuss that. So the question is, number one, you're not allowed to consult an astrologer. There's no question about that. However, if an astrologer tells you stuff unsolicited, right? Let's say an astrologer who's a real astrologer tells you, you know what, it would be dangerous for you to travel. You're allowed to be cautious and take their advice into consideration, meaning that you're not supposed to ignore it if you've been told. So you're not allowed to seek it, but if it falls in your lap, it's something that you should not ignore. There's a famous story where someone had a dream that if they traveled, they would face tremendous danger. And they blew it off. They said, it's just a stupid dream. They had the same dream 3 nights in a row. And they went to their rabbi, and they said, Rabbi, I've had this dream 3 nights in a row that I shouldn't travel because it's dangerous. I'm supposed to take a trip. I think I'm going on a boat or something. And what should I do? The rabbi said, well, look, if you have the dream 3 nights in a row and it's a clear dream, I would be reluctant to ignore the dream. And this fellow said, you know what, I think dreams are stupid, I'm going to go anyway. And of course we know what happened to this guy. He didn't survive whatever happened.
That doesn't prove anything.
No, it doesn't prove anything. It's just saying that you're wise if you're cautious.
Well, sure, if you don't go on a trip, you're not going to get hurt on that trip.
The reality is that the rabbi would have been wise to recommend not to take, not to go in a way which could be hazardous, right? Which would be not saying to the person, don't get out of bed for the next month. I mean that there are certain things that are more dangerous than other things. You know, if you take a ride in your car, in a Jeep in the Himalayas, which I once did, you're taking your life into your hands. So if you've been told, and again, this is a case where someone was given outside, it's like outside information, they were warned, you know what, this may not be a propitious time for traveling. So it would be wise for the person to reconsider taking that cab up to, you know, the top of the mountain. But it doesn't mean that they shouldn't, you know, take a trip to, you know, the local pharmacy or the local department store. You know, they could walk there and not feel any danger at all. We have time for one more, or should we cut? Okay, so we'll stop now for benching, but if there are more questions, I'll be here for the rest of the week.